Thanks very much indeed, Robin and Karen and Stuart and Dale and Steve. Where are you, Steve? Oh, down the back over there. Okay, thank you very much indeed. That was outstanding. As you can see from what Robin just walked you through, the engagement, particularly in those types of markets that are regional, is critical because we are a big fish in a small pond. So it's absolutely critical that we have exceptional engagement with the community not just being the council or the state government or the planning authorities, but the people that live there and their children and the community groups. And in my view, we've hit it out of the ballpark at Rockhampton, and we're going to continue to do that around the portfolio. So summary in a nutshell, before I ask Matthew to come up and then we'll get into Q&A. We've got well-positioned retail assets in Australia, both in suburban locations, which we're going to see today, Merrylands and Wetherill Park, as well as strong regional areas such as the Illawarra, Rockhampton and Townsville, as we've discussed. These assets are generally in markets that have very good growth prospects. We're driving the retail assets up the retail hierarchy appropriately and strategically without overbuilding too fast. We're creating shopping destinations that are relevant, that are highly engaged with the community and the regions in which they're located. We're positioning our residential communities, particularly our larger ones, that are well anchored with retail domicile town centres on a horizontal mixed-use basis, together with other facilities such as schools, colleges, aquatic centres, the list goes on, and doing that quicker, earlier and faster in order to create the genesis of the community and in such a manner that the people buying the land from us will be proud to say, I am part of that Stockland community and I love it. And I think what Karen mentioned earlier about the folk buying the independent living units in the Highlands retirement living village because their children already own a block of land and have built a house 2 kilometres away is testimony to what we're referring to. As Dale covered, a very rigorous application of our disciplines. We're not going to start building anything until we're sure about what we're getting, until we're sure about the economics, and we're reasonably certain about the design intent and where we want to end up. I think we've got an exceptional team with loads of experience to deliver. And as Karen said, and I can only re-emphasise it, that the focus on the community is critical because it's a licence to operate and it is being embedded in everything that we do. So thanks for coming today. I'm excited about this afternoon. I'm looking forward to getting all of your feedback about what you think about Wetherill Park today before we start the project. So it's actually good to go there today because it's a cracker of a shopping centre, but we haven't done anything to it yet. So you'll see it before we start and then go back at the end of stage one and then go back later on when we finish the whole thing, and it'll give you a good sense as to the before and after. And similarly at Merrylands, you'll see the new piece trading, some part of it under construction, and then the good news is there's a little bit left of the original 1970s shopping centre, the Coles supermarket and about 8 shops, I think, Steve, that you'll completely appreciate what we mean when we say that the original centre, whilst in and of itself traded very well and was leading edge in 1970, is obsolete. But it'll give you a good feel for what we're doing and how we're doing it. So thank you again for your attendance and your attention. And I'd ask Matthew to come up for Q&A. Steve?
Okay, we've allowed half an hour for questions before lunch, and the Q&A will be put on the website, as I said, so that we won't be talking about anything here that's market sensitive without talking to everybody else, which is obviously very important. Who'd like to go first? John.
John Richmond.
And this is, sorry, I should have said, this is questions about everything, including the residential, retirement living and capital management, not just commercial property. So go for your life.
Excellent. On Avon, just wondering what the integration costs are likely to be that you mentioned that you'll be taking this year?
About $2 million.
$2 million.
Yeah. We're doing it very, very rigorously, including internal resources and external. But that is the direct cost of the integration program. That doesn't include redundancies and other costs. That is purely the cost of that process itself.
And then given your propensity to now to develop and own some of the smaller shopping centres within the communities projects, like Highlands, for example, does that mean that we can expect less C&I development profits from, you know, the sale of those to third parties that you historically would have done?
That is correct. Most of the C&I profits that have come through have not been from the sale of retail centres. They've been from more like industrial land trading. That will continue. If you're able to go to North Lakes, for example, you will see a huge business park there, which we've developed, where we're selling the land, making a profit, but we're also selling it to groups that have a synergy with the residential community, like indoor climbing, skate park, rollerblading and the like, where that actually gets community engagement. We're not just selling it to another industrial operator, so we won't chase the last dollar. It'd be more important to get the right people in there as well.
So the sort of forward inventory value will hold more or less to what, I can't remember what it is today,
but yeah.
C&I inventory, you're not expecting that to come back?
No, we've flagged previously we'll make $5-10 million a year,
yep,
out of that kind of activity. And we are, as we buy land, like the Rockhamptons, the Caloundra Downs and so on, they will have that kind of land. For employment generation, which we will subdivide and sell, we will not be building those facilities ourselves unless it's to incubate things to get going for the broader community.
And just last question from me. Looking at the pie charts that you put up before, looking at where the investment portfolio was, or sorry, is today versus where it'll be in, say, 5 to 7 years' time, what are the moving parts to get there in terms of the quantum of divestments in office and industrial assets? On the one hand, and then in terms of growing the retail portion of the pie,
yeah,
the rough split between new acquisitions and development?
Well, most of the increase in retail comes through development. We have not allowed for much at all acquisition in there. If we were able to do that, then it's likely we would accelerate sale of office and industrial. So this is why we've said indicative 5 to 7 years, because these things can change. It shows strategic intent. But most of the retail growth comes through development. We haven't budgeted on much acquisition in there. If we were able to do that, we would fund that through further sales. Now, the key for this is obviously to change the mix of the assets towards higher order retail from office and industrial. We're very, very committed to that strategy. Even if office markets boomed for a while, it wouldn't give us the temptation to come back in. It's a different methodology that's required to make money out of office, much more trading focused, and it doesn't really fit with us, as is about long-term value creation through development. What we want to do, though, is make sure that we always have our mix of recurring and non-recurring earnings, or trading earnings, 60 to 80%, 20 to 40%, and we want to grow our residential business. So by definition, we want to grow our retail or our rental footprint as well. And we also get annuity earnings through retirement living, which bolsters that 60 to 80%. That's why we need to be measured in our sales of office and industrial. But if a party came along and said, I've got a couple of $1 billion worth of retail assets that fit the bill and fit your criteria, I read them on the slides today, how about you'd like to swap that for your office and industrial buildings, I think we'd have a good talk about that. So we are very much focused on getting there sooner if we can, but the main impediment to that is our ability to acquire, not to develop, and we're not budgeting on acquisitions.
Great, and you're able to hit that sort of, we'll say the 30 to 40% of the retail being major regional versus 0% today through development alone.
Correct. Everything that you've seen on the pipeline today would get us there. So the biggest impediment there is our ability to get all of the approvals in place and get our act in gear. But most of those projects that will get us there are actually shovel ready. There's a few DAs that we have to get through on certain projects, but most of them are on the way to being there.
Thank you.
Good morning, John Friedman, UBS. A couple of questions, firstly on retail and then on resi. On resi, and this may be one that several of you might want to comment on. Firstly, looking at the yields, I understand the comments about the long term and the importance of moving these centres up the hierarchy. The yields that you're quoting, it's the ones that are, I guess, have been slowed down given the GFC, which is pretty understandable. We've all gone through it. How do you see those yields versus starting yields versus the cost of capital, firstly? And in terms of the yields on this type of developments, are we looking at yields in the future that are perhaps lower than what we might have enjoyed, if I can use that word, in the past?
Okay. Well, if we talk about the... I'll let John add on to this in a moment, but if we talk about cost of capital, we want to be in a position where the starting yield, cash, washes its face versus today's equity return through dividend or today's cost of debt, which is around about that 7.5% mark. We also want to get growth through rental growth that gives us a total return in excess of our weighted average cost of capital, which it does. Only a small proportion of that 12% plus, and we are saying 12% plus, we want to be higher, but only a small proportion of that 12% plus comes through from capital gain or cap rate compression because of moving it up the hierarchy, because in terms of our cost of capital, all that does is add a few cents to the NTA and doesn't really move anybody's needle. So it's got to come from today's return, washing its face, plus genuine rental growth. When it comes to cost of capital, though, one of the things you'll find us doing is that on day one, we will tell you the day one fully leased, which it should be cash yield, and not talk about some more nebulous, you know, stabilised five-year number, which would be 8% odd, if not more. It's day one that counts, because we don't want to put ourselves in a position of dilution on day one. We'll only do that if there's exceptional circumstances, such as there was with Townsville, where we had to defend our position, and Merrylands, where we had to basically hold it for a year longer than we expected, and the holding cost eroded the return. Moving forward, John, how confident are we getting the returns?
No, I think you summarised it appropriately, Matthew. I mean, the initial yields, just to clarify, first full operating year post-completion. Inevitably, a lot of these projects finish in September or October or something like that, so we take the very first full year in calculating those initial yields. And, yeah, we are striving, John, for, to the best of our ability, 7.5, so it isn't dilutive. And then very quickly you get some reasonable uplift. The other, Merrylands aside, the other thing in assets like Shell Harbour and Greenhills, when we start work on that, and Wetherill Park, that you'll see later, is that there'll be reversion in the old mall as well. So you do start to see uptick over time that comes out of that as well, particularly when you move shops around. And we experienced that at Rockhampton, because shops that were undersized and over-trading in the Big W Woolworths side came out and went into the new fashion precinct anchored by Sports Girl and Witchery and the like. And then you got an opportunity to go and backfill and remix the space in the existing centre, and you actually get an uptick. And we enjoyed a pretty substantial uptick at Rockhampton on that basis. And again, you'll see that over the next year or two in the valuation. So 7.5 compound annual growth rates, given that there is no CapEx that's deferred because you've just spent it. I mean, the good news about Merrylands is when you're finished, you're done. You're done for the foreseeable at least 10 or 12 years, maybe longer, because the plant's brand new. So no deferred maintenance, no deferred capital expenditure. 7.5 average compound annual growth rate, including, you know, reversions in years 5, 6, and 7 when leases roll over, probably about 4.5. There's your 12, because there is very little CapEx to speak of because it's brand new. And if you do get good cap rate compression post-completion, then obviously your development IRR will be better than 12. Now, I'm keeping it quite straightforward, but that's what we're striving for.
Now, I don't want to labour the point as well, but in all of these cases, if we wanted day one to be 0.5% higher, we could do that. We'd do it three ways. The first would be not to be spending what we see as, what some see as discretionary sustainability expenditure, which we see as non-discretionary, and we'd be spending substantially less. I think in the case of Shell Harbour, we're spending
$15 million
on initiatives that are not mandated through the development approval, but are future-proofing the asset. Secondly, we could go for a lower quality retail mix with retailers that will pay more rent on day one, increase the yield, but they're not doing anything for the local community. I mean, you go to centres and you can see where they've got six mobile phone shops and 10 $2 shops or whatever, and yes, the day one rent might be higher, but it's not the right sustainable outcome for the long term. And the third one is to do what our industry has traditionally always done, and that's to add on 40 shops more than you actually need, back yourself, you'll lease them, boost the return, but pay the price when, you know, you've got vacancies and soft deals 2 or 3 years down the track. As John said before, if anything, we're building not quite as much as we need, rather than building that extra 40 just to get the yield up to 8% and, you know, tick that magic box, because it's total false economy. In our
yeah,
view.
Indeed. And look, that's very important to appreciate. At Shell Harbour, there's actually embedded in the $330 million some cost that enables us to add more to it when the market's ready for it. We haven't conveniently taken it out and shoved it into a future WIP account. Ditto Townsville. Parts of Townsville that we're building now really will enable us to put future levels on top of it down the track. And as Stephen already characterised in his presentation, we own considerable chunks of land adjacent to the current project that will enable us to expand onto it as well. And you know, you can always run the argument about that shouldn't be in there, or it should or should be somewhere else. I think at the end of the day, if you look at it from a totality of investment and what are you trying to achieve and where do we want to end up, you're better off spending the money and future-proofing it now, whether it be structurally reinforcing it for the future, or in the case of Shell Harbour, 25% of our electricity consumption there will be generated by us through the tri-generation plant. You can ask Nathan Yeo in the audience here later on the bus what a tri-generation plant is, because I haven't got a bloody clue. But it's gas-generated electricity. You know, there's a whole lot of benefits, heat exchange and things that come with it. I'm not a techno fellow. But that combined with 7,000 metres of solar on the roof means that a quarter of our electricity need post-completion of Shell Harbour will be generated by us. Now, about half of our operating expenses are recoverable and about half aren't. So you can do the math that inevitably the operating expenses will actually move favourably for the retailers. And because retailers don't really differentiate between an operating cost or a property tax or a minimum rent, in their mind it's all rent, you get it back in minimum rent.
I think you had a residential question.
Sure. Just in terms of residential, your comments earlier sounded reasonably positive. You said the momentum had continued into October. It's probably even, in my view, more positive than what you said earlier in this financial year, where you said there were lots of risks. Are there risks such as delay in delivery of land? If you take away the interest rates, which is always there, employment, etc., are the rains, you know, is that a problem for you? Are you worried about being able to deliver all of this?
Rain is an issue, and I never want to use weather as an excuse, heaven forbid, but rain is an issue, particularly in Melbourne, and you know, it's well needed, so it's good for the wider community. That's the major reason why we'll have a skew in earnings from first half to second half. But unless it continues to be torrential, all of that should be well and truly done by the end of the financial year. So the risk to production not getting us there is quite low. But you will see a skew, but that will be reflected by a higher in the bin position at the end of December. What we have done, just to build on that, is to make ourselves, as much as we possibly can, a one-issue company, that it's down to interest rates and the impact on residential. You've got enough things to worry about. We don't need to have so many moving parts that it just becomes too hard for people, particularly when we've got overseas shareholders who have, I won't say limited knowledge of residential markets, but lesser knowledge. We need to just talk to them about the single issue that is most confronting us in terms of performance, and that's interest rates and the impact on the residential market. And my comments before were quite genuine, that in November so far it seems to be going okay, But, you know, these are very, very early early days, and I think it's because people were giving a little bit of breathing space and it was so well telegraphed, and hopefully that will be enough for people to take it in their stride.
If you look at your strategy of positioning the portfolio so that you're below the median in your local areas in terms of cost, how much of the portfolio would you say, roughly, and it's probably a guesstimate, would be sitting beating that metric?
Oh, no, I can. We look at this quite rigorously in terms of the product that we get on the market. I can tell you that in our residential communities, about 80% of our packages, if we package them up, would be below 450,000. The majority of that is actually below $400,000, and we have a growing proportion that is below $350,000. Every 1% increase in interest rates means that we have to bring our entry price down by $30,000 to compensate people and keep their repayments at the same level. So every day that goes by, we're working with our builders to make our product more efficient and therefore more affordable. One of the revelations of this, though, and if you have the time, I do encourage you to go and have a look. If you're ever near Melbourne Airport, go to Craigieburn or Brisbane Airport, go and look at North Lakes, and actually go and look at an affordable house, because it's actually very nice. People have a view that it's cheap and nasty. It's basically an apartment on land with a garage. The quality is just as good. The amenity is just as good. The layout is just as good. The efficiency is just as good. The major difference is that the cost of building that house is about $950 to $1,000 a square metre. The cost of building the equivalent apartment is about $4,500, $4,000, depending which market you're in. So there's a big cost benefit and competitive advantage that well-located, affordable land and housing has against the apartment market, which is encouraging a lot of people into that style of development. You can buy a three-bedroom house. Yes, it's a bit further out for $300,000. That won't buy you a studio in any capital city these days. So there is actually a push towards that kind of living rather than apartments because of affordability as well.
Thank you.
Stephen Rich, Credit Suisse. Just a couple of questions, firstly on the retail stabilisation and then secondly on capital management. So firstly, just maybe one for John, with respect to the stabilisation, some of these lower yields, are there any mechanisms that you apply to proceed effectively the five-year rent review mechanism to try and get the yield up a little bit quicker and obviously a shorter-term IRR?
We try to avoid the, you know, rent stabilisation theory. I think Stephen Bull can comment in a moment if you don't mind, but if you, in the case of something like Marylands, because we're going through this process of decommissioning the old GLA when we recommission the new GLA, there's virtually no stabilisation. I mean, I'm staggered every month when I look at the sales as to the business we're still generating out of what you're going to see later today. I mean, you scratch your head. But it's because we're keeping all the custom there. Yes, we've lost a bit of custom, but it's not like the, and I won't name examples, but there are examples in the past of complete demolition, put back a new shopping centre 3 years later, and in our experience, four years to get people back. So we're trying to avoid that. We're trying to avoid, you know, a 3, 4, 5 year stabilisation type approach. But what we are doing, which I think is sensible, is ensuring that the shops that open now can survive during the construction process because they're in there on much lower rents. And when the whole project is finished, they're at market. So they ramp up to market through the process. So they're not paying market today, but they will pay market when the shopping centre is finished. And then beyond that, their rents grow at CPI plus a margin or fixed 5%. Generally, most of our leases are fixed 5%. The other thing that we do that I'm rather proud of is we actually give retailers flexibility. Gee, that's good, isn't it? You know, we actually say, well, they might say to us, well, we're going to spend $485,000 on the fit out. Can we have a 7-year lease? And we go, absolutely. And they sometimes look at us like, you really will give us a seven-year lease? Well, yes, we will, because you've told us you're going to spend $485,000 and you need to burn off the depreciation and amortisation over a longer lease period. We're quite relaxed with that. But what we do ask for in a situation like that is that there is some mechanism, perhaps in year 5 or 6, where the rental increase might be a fixed 6 or 7% or 8% rather than CPI plus 2 or 5, if that makes sense. So in the case of Maryland specifically, not that your question was relevant to Maryland, but it's a good case study, is that there are shops in there with leases that are probably 8 years, because they're 3 years during the project, or maybe four, and then four after that. So there will be a chance at Maryland's if they perform very well, and my instinct is, just looking at what I'm seeing now, they're going to, knock on wood, is that by about year four, which would be probably 2015, you know, some good reversion will start to kick in.
Great. And just with respect to the Greenfields developments?
Yep. Well, they're a little bit different. I mean, you asked that question earlier on, and you know, just to re-emphasise that all of the land in Stockland residential communities and the things that we've been referring to is held at lower of cost and net realisable value, as you know. So, but when we start to look at the shopping centre component, we actually determine on a reasonable basis what the market value of that land would be as a standalone shopping centre and create the feasibility according to that market value. Now, in the case of North Shore Townsville, you're starting off with a very small project. It'll be a successful Woolworths, a very well-leased neighbourhood centre, but it is master planned and zoned to get to 40,000 square metres, plus about 20,000 metres of bulky retail and, you know, commercial uses that go with it. So over a period of time, because the land cost is being imputed now, we should make good reversion or better return over time as we start to add the next supermarket, the next discount department store, and so on, in and of itself as a commercial investment. But can I just stress the point again? The reason why we're commissioning these retail centres early on is because it fuels the growth or the rate of sale of the retail residential lots, i.e. you sell more lots quicker than you otherwise would and, you know, knock on wood, at a high margin. So we look at it from a whole of life, one total return, one IRR for Stockland perspective. So whilst the shopping centre may in and of itself at the conclusion of the neighbourhood project show a slight capital devaluation with parentheses around it, A, you'll make that back over time as it becomes larger, and B, you've made it up in spades in the trading business anyway. Apart from the fact that you're developing a good, sustainable, long-term community for the people.
Great. And just a final one. Matthew, there's been a lot of talk today and obviously in the market more generally about the spread between cost of capital and deployment IRRs, et cetera. Can you just talk a little bit with respect to your GPT disposal on those metrics and specifically with respect to timing of disposal?
Of why we sold it and when we sold it then?
Exactly.
Well, one of the, and be careful how I say this, timing of disposal was dictated by us coming to the conclusion that there was no strategic benefit in holding that stake. And we had gone through a massively rigorous process of internal discussion and discussion with external parties to determine whether there was any real optionality in that stake. And we didn't want to sell it too soon and regret it afterwards, because you only get one chance. That was a very, very rigorous process. Having come to that view, we decided to sell. My view is that when you make a decision to sell something, you get on and do it. You don't tempt fate and be at the slave of looking up in the morning and see if Wall Street's tanked or not. You get on with it. And one of the signs of success that it is the right time to sell is that nobody expected us to do it then. By definition, if people expected it, then obviously we're going to get a lower price because people will factor it in and start to allow for it. That was the outcome that we achieved.
Great. So just with respect to the other timing around the dividend date, there's no implications of sort of the treatment of earnings?
No, not at all. It makes no difference at all.
Great.
It's all the same money.
Thank you.
Hi, Jackie Tin from Citi. With respect to how you mentioned, you have the one feasibility across the retail and the residential developments. Just wondering if you can elaborate on what unlevered IRRs you're willing to accept on the retail component, and also what that means for the entire residential development.
Yeah. Well, given that we have one feasibility for the whole lot, the unlevered IRR for the retail component is not that relevant. We will look at it, but as you can imagine, it's 6.5% initial yield plus growth, so it might end up being 9% on a standalone basis. But there'll be more to come in the future as we add on the space. The bottom line, though, we want to keep this as simple as we possibly can in terms of how we get that message across. And just to reiterate what Stephen was saying before, let's say we spend $25 million, $30 million, because that's how much these retail centres cost to build. And the difference between what we receive on day one and what we would love to receive on day one to make it viable in its own right, let's say it's 2.5%, which is quite extreme in that view as well in terms of value creation. That's, let's say, $700,000 a year. In projects like this, our marginal return, our marginal gross profit from every block that we sell is about $60,000. So if we get an extra 10 sales that year in cash, we have more than made up for the diminution that comes through the retail asset. Now, we gave you an example before of what's happened to the sales rate at North Shore Townsville as a result of us starting the retail, and you can only imagine that the total return of that project will go through the roof because of our decision to build the retail early. It adds percentages, not just basis points, but percentages to the total return from that development if we take it over a 2 or 3 year period versus a build the retail or not build the retail. The same will happen at Highlands, the same is happening at New Haven in Perth, and there'll be many other examples of that as well, where we'll incubate the retail to get the residential going, because our commitment to doing that is not just a win for the customer, it's a win for our engagement with the local authorities and the approval authorities as well, because no other group that I'm aware of does this. So it gives us an advantage in that we practice what we preach.
Thanks. And also, when you mentioned your target year one cash yield of 7.5% for developments, is that the same for any acquisitions that you may do in retail? And whether your previous target, I suppose, of initially being accretive on day one for acquisitions, is that also the same going forward, given that there may be some deferred capex on a lot of these retail assets that you may be looking to buy?
Sure. I think all group that runs their capital responsibly would have a target of accretion or at least break even on day one. But it's what happens afterwards that counts. If we had that as a benchmark for everything that we did, we may miss some very, very good opportunities that may pay dividends for us much greater 2 or 3 years down the track. What we've got to do is, when that does happen, is have the courage to do it and to the courage to articulate why we have done so. We don't have any current plans to do so. Don't read anything into that. On an acquisition perspective, it would be similar, but again, it's horses for courses. Every acquisition is different. What you can be guaranteed of, though, is that when we tell you the metrics, they will be absolutely plain vanilla, and if there are reasons for us to break that rule, then we will have to validate that and explain that to you. But we don't have any current intention of doing so.
And can I just re-emphasise, Jackie, that I mean, we see a lot of stuff. We see a lot of opportunities, but the only ones that we're focused on are the ones that I characterised early on. You know, if it is a smaller asset that we can see because of market growth, be it population growth or growth in the economy in that trade area, can justify a larger asset in reasonable short order, then we'll act. If we can't, I mean, I don't see a lot of logic in buying a 15,000 square metre shopping centre and just sit on it for the next 15 years, because you're not going to get a lot of growth. I think we can do better things with your equity.
Similarly, if there was a regional centre, even if it has expansion potential in the future and it comes on the market at 6%, 6.25% plus growth, we can't afford that. And strategically, it wouldn't make sense for us to do so. And given the relative cost of capital between us and the sovereign funds, as one pool of buyers, if we were front of that queue, I'd probably be a bit concerned in any case. We've got to find with us a different angle that uses our expertise to create additional value further than just being a plain vanilla when we're in the same queue as everybody else.
Sure, thanks. And just a last question. During the GFC, I think we mentioned that there was a lot of upfront incentives given for tenants for fit-outs and, you know, when they were moving into retail developments. Have we seen that change at all recently, or are they still quite capital constrained?
Stuart, would you like to respond to that? It's in relation to incentives in retail property.
I think we're still finding that incentives are more than pre-GFC type periods. Pre-GFC for our projects, we're probably sitting around the 40,000 to 30,000 a shop. We're probably sitting now more at the 60 to 80, depending on who those retailers are, particularly the franchisees or the independents which rely on bank finance and can't get that bank finance because they're squeezed out of the market at the moment. So we sometimes assist. And as John says, we will take extra rent or we will structure something to get a return on that extra money.
Just, I'm not going to get into the banking debate, but just an observation that bank lending for residential mortgaging is robust. It's obviously a hot topic at the moment in terms of the price for that. Bank desire to do business with big corporates with a good credit rating like ourselves is robust. In the middle, small to medium enterprise, which includes a lot of property developers I'd put into that camp, plus a lot of our retailers, it is very, very hard to get finance. And when you can get it, the cost is quite prohibitive. Now, that's a challenge for us, obviously, in this particular space, but it's also an opportunity for us to use our muscle to buy better and use that leverage against some of the smaller groups as well.
And Jackie, just to round out what Stuart said, it's incumbent upon us in these circumstances where the incentives for project leasing, and I want to be clear, it's not generally in the operating assets and it's certainly not for lease renewals. All of the retail lease renewals we do not require any capital expenditure at all. The fit-outs are done by the retailer and we do not contribute. There is some contribution perhaps on new leasing, but it's not to the same degree that it is in the projects. It's mainly in the projects. And as Stuart said, it's about double what it is traditionally. So what it means is that we have to be very careful about who we give the money to. So there's a much higher degree of discipline as to where that capital is allocated, because you want to allocate it to retailers that are going to be around. You know, not the proverbial Johnny come latelys, if you know what I mean.
All right, we'll take a couple more questions, Richard.
Just following on that question, so is it only in fit-outs that you'll give incentives? Is there any rent freeze?
No rent freeze in retail, Rich. It's all fit-out contribution.
Okay.
So because they can't, particularly the SMEs and the smaller, you know, regional players who are having difficulties with their banks. Yeah, fit-out contributions. Different to office, where there is a lot of rent-free, not the case in retail.
One final question, John.
I was wondering how Calendar Downs affects your residential EBIT margin guidance of 25 to 30%, if at all.
In the longer term, given our land price, which is less than 10,000 per lot, we have a lot of infrastructure costs, but if it didn't boost our margins, then I would be very surprised. But it's going to start quite slowly in terms of volumes before it ramps up. Probably in 3-4 years time it will ramp up to very significant volumes, but it will start at a slower pace than that. Okay, thanks everyone for attending. I think we now have time for some lunch, and then we'll, for those of you who are joining us this afternoon for the site tour, we look forward to doing that with you.